Staying Alive, The Science of Living Healthier, Happier and Longer by Dr. Kate Gregorovich. Kate is well known to Australian audiences. She's a geriatrician and internal medicine physician working in both acute hospital medicine and in the community. She's a doctor twice, actually. She's also got a PhD looking at psychosocial factors involving old age frailty. She's published many studies and is a go-to commentator for media like the ABC and Sydney Morning Herald and the Melbourne Age and News.com Australia. And she lives in Melbourne with her husband and three children. Kate is also the director of Project 6. I'll start again. Project 3612, an online well-being and exercise program giving women over 40 the tools they need to improve strength and vitality. Kate, it's a real pleasure to have you on, and thanks for being able to spend some time with us. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
This is a comprehensive book. We'll only scratch the surface of, hopefully, the most important surfaces, because it's a veritable compendium of health, and you've left no stone unturned in explaining how the body works and how to make it work better. So was the intention to make it as complete as possible?
So what people don't realise is that the science of ageing is actually relatively new. And I think that's because, you know, we're living in the first time in human history and most people can get older. And there's all these fascinating biological processes going on in our body, which are part of life, that do lead to what we think of as ageing. And so I really wanted people to understand some of that science and understand how it impacts our physical health, and then in turn to understand how lifestyle factors can have a positive effect on staying really well into older age.
Yes, or a negative one, but we'll accentuate the positive.
Yes.
Why do women still live longer than men? Because we, you know, the men don't get eaten by the saber-toothed tigers anymore. So what is the reason?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So it's a worldwide phenomenon, although the actual difference in life expectancy varies hugely. But women do have some biological advantages. And so having two X chromosomes rather than an X and a Y chromosome means that you get better immune function. There might also be some hormonal function because women, hormonal reasons, because women seem to be protected against cardiovascular disease. But really sadly, one of the big reasons for men's excess mortality in younger years is actually trauma and suicide. And so it really highlights that health is not just our biology. There's so many social factors we can look at. And so finding ways to support men's mental health would be a really great way to try and close the life expectancy gap.
I seized on this in the book. I forget where it was, but it really surprised me. As a mother, you will live longer if you have your children after the age of 33, twice as long on average as the woman who has all her children before age 29. Why is being an older mum so beneficial? How solid is this?
Look, this is probably one of these things where it's probably correlation, not causation. And I suspect that it's more that women who are able to conceive and carry a child when they're over 40 might be biologically a little younger than other women. So although there is that evidence, I'm certainly, I'm not 40 yet, but I'm done with having children. I'm not going to try out that theory and see if it works.
Yes, if you give birth after 40, according to this study, and I think it was quite a big study, wasn't it? Your chances of reaching old age quadruple, but that is reassuring for older mothers, isn't it?
Look, it is in a way, and, you know, there are some, you know, there are, we all do need some, you know, check on things in pregnancy, and certain things are higher risk in older age.
Yeah.
But as I said, it could just be a sign that, you know, you're quite healthy.
Mitochondrial damage, telomere shortening, epigenetic aging, protein degradation. So let's assume some knowledge, as I'm sure there is among our audience. How do we stop something like inflammaging, for example, please, Kate? Because here in New Zealand, we can't all go to saunas and then plunge out into the snow like the Finns do, because you mentioned that in your book. First of all, why is this good for them and what can we do instead?
So immune changes in aging are thought to be one of the key mechanisms related to both age-related disease like cardiovascular disease and dementia, and also to the development of frailty. And I think with this coronavirus pandemic, it's also really highlighted that older adults don't have the same level of ability within their immune system to fight off diseases. So when we get older, we're not as good at making antibodies. But because we've got some more changes within our cells that you referred to, we've got higher levels of immune activity as well, so inflammation. And so inflammation is influenced by so many different lifestyle factors. The one that you talked about, the sauna, is really interesting, that people having saunas seems to have immune modulating effects that decrease inflammation. There's been links with sauna use and being helpful for people with depression. But things like exercise, getting enough sleep, even social connection, the foods we eat related to the microbiome, all of these things can have positive influences as well.
By the time we turn 60, most of us will still have one third of our lives to live. I think that's the publisher's blurb, not you. But this is my question. Setting aside good and bad genes for a moment, how long should you and I now expect to live if we have moderate habits and good exercise? My habits have been a bit immoderate in the past, along with a lot of people. But what can we expect?
Look, as a doctor, I know that, you know, life doesn't always happen the way you're expecting it to. And I think it's actually, instead of thinking about, you know, how many years you've got ahead, it's actually a lot more important to think about what's going on in the present. And there's no point living as long as possible if you're not enjoying yourself and not giving yourself the best possible conditions to feel really engaged in life, to feel like you're able to do something that's got meaning and purpose. And so, say, as an example, having a good night's sleep, over the longer term, there are a lot of studies linking getting enough sleep and good cardiovascular health, good cognitive health. But sleep as well, if you've had a good night's sleep, you're just able to concentrate better, your memory works better, you're in a better mood. And so I think it's really important to bring it back to the here and now rather than just thinking about the possibilities of what's going to be in the future.
Okay, but I still want to ask you, how old do you want to get to in good health, Kate? Because people do talk about this. How old do I want to be as long as I've got my health?
I mean, I would say as old as possible, but I'd also say I genuinely don't think about how long I'm going to live and what's going to happen very often.
No.
Because as I said, you know, I know I've got a family history of dementia. I know it's a possibility. And all I can do is try and live as well as I can in the present, set up the right conditions, and also get the most out of life.
You're a great one for living in the present, and I'll get to that later. But just to worry this question slightly more, we know if we stay hungry and don't turn the heaters on in the house, for instance, it tends to increase longevity, but no one wants to live like that. We do need our older age not to be painful and hindered by incapacity, don't we, really, if possible?
We do want to try and set up the best possible conditions we can, pardon me, to be really well into old age. You know, one example is doing resistance training. So the biggest cause of disability in older age in our societies is actually inactivity. And, you know, this is something we can all do something about. So keeping aerobically fit is good, but the thing that most people don't do is strength training. And particularly for women, this is so important because women are more likely to be dependent in older age compared to men. And some of this can be offset by keeping muscles strong.
Okay. Staying Alive, the Science of Living Healthier, Happier and Longer. Dr. Kate Gregorovich is with us. So it's the science of managing, or better still, avoiding heart disease, diabetes, mm-hmm. dementia. At what age do you think we have left it too late to obviate serious conditions? When do we need, ideally, to start being really healthy?
Look, a lot of studies show that even in pretty advanced age, you can still get benefits from things like exercise. But what I would say in terms of, they also show that your health behaviours in younger age can have legacy effects right into older age. And so I think the simple answer is it's never too late or too early to start thinking about lifestyle factors that can improve your health.
All right. That's a fair enough answer. Hello. This is the first one from listeners, of which there are a number. Could you please ask Kate about the impact of sugar on longevity and how important it is to cut it and perhaps alcohol out of the diet, says Julia.
Yeah. So look, with the food side of things, I like to focus on, you know, I'd say we eat meals, we don't eat macronutrients. And we've got this huge focus that's been going for so many years. At first it was fat was really bad, then it was carbohydrates are really bad. And, you know, none of these things in themselves are inherently bad. And saying carbohydrates is a very broad group. It includes everything from your whole grains that are unprocessed, things like fraka or barley, all the way to a teaspoon of table sugar. And I think what's more important to focus on is including lots of vegetables in your diet, getting lots of fiber. And yes, things like added sugar, they are associated with a lot of negative health things. But I prefer to sort of, when I'm giving out nutritional advice, think about positives and what the good things are to do rather than focusing on one demon ingredient to cut out.
It manifests, you say, in the small everyday decisions we make. And I love this because this is your philosophical core in a way. You know, will I eat this piece of cake now, the delicious taste versus the risk of diabetes? Will I have another glass of wine, the nice buzz versus the risk of cancer? Will I go to bed or just stream another episode of the TV saga I like? You're right. It does come down to that all day and all the choices we make, doesn't it?
Exactly, it does. And so what I've really hoped with this book, as well as laying out the evidence, I've laid out a framework for people to try and make changes in a way that can actually look at how you can improve your quality of life in the present.
We don't all have your willpower, though. You can have the second helping of cake, even though you've just told yourself not to, with a series of very good reasons why not.
I think I don't know that willpower is quite the right word. As I said, you know, I do exercise pretty much every day, whether it's going for a walk or doing my weights. And I don't do it because I'm thinking this is really good for me, or, you know, I don't think of it in terms of burning calories. I think of it that I know that I'm going to feel better after I do this. I know that I'm going to be more productive. I'll be in a better mood. And so most of these things I don't do out of willpower. I don't do out of punishing myself. I do it because I know it will make me feel better.
I know even you aren't perfect, because you have trouble during mindfulness, don't you, when you do mindfulness exercises?
Yeah, like the evidence around meditation is really interesting, and it does, people who long-term meditators seem to have some positive measurable changes in their brain when they've done some brain imaging. But I must say, for me personally, it's something that I really struggle with, especially because I live in a house with small children, so it's very hard to get those thoughts together, but perhaps it's a skill that I'll work on one day in the future.
Here's a delightful email from Joy Mace of Devonport. My rollerblades broke about 18 months ago, and for my 80th birthday in 9 days, I'm planning to replace them when available. A good form of exercise on the relatively smooth pavement outside our home, could you ask? Also considering a cycle, which my son thinks is more suitable, may get both. I wear full ice hockey protective gear, all padded, and you can't see much of me, but I plan to get newer wrist guards. My mother helped milk 100 cows, getting up at 4 o'clock, and she lived till 93, so I'm hoping I will age well if I keep active, says Joy, which is fantastic for Joy. Would you advise that level of activity in most, I mean, can most people, older people, exercise and be more active than they actually think they can?
Oh, they are. And look, I am yet to meet anyone who's 80 on their rollerblades. I'd love to see a photo, Joy. But age is absolutely not a barrier to exercise. The one thing I would say is if you have been relatively inactive, you know, and this even goes right back into younger age, like people in their 30s and 40s, you don't always want to go and join the hardcore gym straight up. It's good to get a bit of technique to build your strength up gradually. But definitely staying active into older age is a fantastic way to enjoy life for as long as possible.
Hello, Kate, says Roland. I've heard that longevity is in your genes. Let's talk a little bit more about genes, can we? So you look at how long your parents live to get an understanding of your own life expectancy. Can you please expand on this, says Roland, to give me a better understanding of the percentage of genes as a factor in longevity?
So look, if you've got parents who live past 100, then congratulations, you've had a great start at achieving a very long life. But genes actually is probably only about 25% of longevity. It's probably far, far more related to lifestyle factors, also to some of the socioeconomic factors. So there's still an awful lot that you can do yourself to live as long as possible. And I think a really good example of that is that worldwide life expectancy in 1900 was 31. Now it's 71. And in countries like Australia, and I think probably New Zealand as well, it's actually over 80. So, you know, these aren't genetic changes that have dramatically increased our life expectancy so much. It's so much more to do with medical and public health advances.
A lot of people,
it shows that there are things that we can do.
That's interesting, because a lot of people would have thought much more than 25%, wouldn't they? That's what a lot of us think, and yet it's not as much as we think.
No, it's really not, no.
I'd be interested to know Dr. Kate's views on spirituality and ageing. As much research is suggesting, ageing is a spiritual experience and can be fostered positively or otherwise, says Dr. Richard Egan from the University of Otago School of Medicine. That's a good question, your views on, because I know you have firm views on purpose. So can we talk a bit about that, the purpose you have to have in later life and how much is a benefit of that?
Yeah, and I think that we, you know, humans, we've got this amazing ability to create, to love, to think abstractly about things that aren't immediately in front of us. And with that, I think comes this real drive that we do have a need to feel like our life matters beyond just ourselves, to feel like we're actually contributing, whether that's helping with grandchildren, whether it's volunteering in some capacity. And I think that could link in with spirituality, particularly if someone gets a lot of social connection and internal reward from helping people with connecting with others. And so it's really interesting that these things have actually had measurable biological impacts. And so people with a higher sense of purpose seems to be associated with better cardiovascular health and with a decreased risk of dementia. And just the other part of it is, when I'm talking to people who are trying to improve their health, we've got to find reasons that matter to them to do it. And if someone doesn't feel like their life is worth living, if someone feels really empty, it's really hard to then get motivated to go for a walk and eat some more vegetables. So I almost think that's the starting off point that we need to have when we're making these positive changes.
Okay. So purpose is paramount. But speaking of motivation, the importance of changing your attitudes and how to do that, because you've got a section in here devoted to making change. And you talk about the optimistic heart. How do you start doing that?
So when I'm talking with people about making change, I ask them what's important to them. I ask people just simple things like what they like to do. And then we work together using that framework for people then to feel motivated to change their behaviors. So if for someone, they're looking after their grandchildren is what their most important thing is, then getting stronger so they can be more active to play with them might be a really good motivation to do that. And optimism is a really interesting thing. And people who have higher levels of optimism do seem to do better after a heart attack. And it might be that they've got a better, more of a sense of self-control, so they, or more sense that their behaviors have a positive impact, so they take their blood pressure tablets. But just finding ways to look on the brighter side of life, or just to feel like you do have some control over things, seems to have some positive biological impact.
Little tidbits from your book, the importance of brushing your teeth. Can you remind us again of that? I know we think we know, but still it's worth mentioning.
Yeah, so having dental health is good for your cardiovascular health and good for your brain health as well. There's been studies linking better dental health to a decreased chance of dementia. And so just simple things like brushing your teeth twice a day, checking in with your dentist every 6 months, and flossing is one way that, one simple thing that might be protecting your health. And just as, along with that as well, keeping your teeth really healthy is also a great strategy for enjoying life into the longer term, so you can keep eating food easily.
We'll get to diet, speaking of food, but why do you insist on extra virgin olive oil?
Yeah, so with extra virgin olive oil, it's not as important if you're cooking and frying, but if you're using salads and things, the way extra virgin olive oil is made is that it's cold pressed. And so that means that there's no heating and it maintains more of its nutrients. And I also prefer the flavour. So that's what I would always use on my salads and things.
You're not a complete fan of probiotics for gut health. Why not?
So look, with probiotics, there's some evidence they might help in constipation or after someone's had gastro, but they're not a simple quick fix solution. And the analogy that I use is that you can't grow a seed in concrete. And so I think this idea that we can take a probiotic to make up for not getting enough fiber in our diet is just not going to work. We still need to feed, you know, the garden that lives in our guts with the right kinds of food. The other part of that is that there's an awful lot of positive bacteria in our there's an awful lot of positive bacteria just even in the food that we eat. So I think we shouldn't underestimate the importance of just eating real food.
And in fact, some probiotics they are finding now do bad as well as good, yes? I mean, what will do your gut good may not be the right recipe for my gut. And they reckon one day we'll have customised nutrition for the microbiome down there, but we don't have that yet, do we?
We're not there yet, but there's a lot that we know that we can do. And so, as I said, eating your vegetables, big variety of vegetables and whole grains. I personally very much enjoy fermented foods, so I really like sauerkraut. Yogurt's another good source if that agrees with your tummy. And so there are already things that we can do now. And as our microbiomes are as individual as a fingerprint. So I think it's a really exciting area of research, but one that we don't quite know enough about yet.
I don't know how you found a whole lot of the research you did. You must have spent so long on this book. But if you sleep for 8 hours before a vaccination, as opposed to 4 hours, the vaccine will take better? I didn't know that. Why?
Yeah, it's a great question. I did certainly love doing the research for this book because the science is so interesting. And so sleep has a really important impact on our immune system. And so when we haven't slept enough, it has changes in our cortisol release. It seems to have changes in our immune function. And so they did studies where they gave people enough sleep or people not enough sleep and found that the vaccination had a different effect. So it's just a simple thing. I mean, getting a good night's sleep is its own reward. But if you're getting a vaccination, if you want to try and stay healthy, then even more reason to go to bed at a regular time each night.
We all know people who don't do these things, and you mention this in your book. We all know the stories of the smoker who lived to 102 and the clean living runner who dropped dead of the heart attack at 52, which makes us probably put more of an emphasis than we should on our genetic inheritance. But do we know fully why this still happens?
Look, with those stories, the smoker who lives till 102, that person is memorable in their rarity. Sadly, all the smokers who died at younger ages from smoking-related disease aren't there to tell their story. And so there is a small component of genetics. There's absolutely within health, there's a component of luck. But by and large, the overwhelming evidence is that smokers will die younger and that the runners will live longer.
Could Dr. Kate please elaborate on detox protocols and how to escape the ever-increasing onslaught of toxins in our environment, asks Dana. It's a good question.
Yeah, so the thing is that we've got our liver and our kidneys do a fantastic job of managing the various things that we eat. And so by and large, the idea of detoxing, it's not something that we need to do. It's not something that's got to have health benefits. And it's far rather than, I guess, focusing on things like a quick fix, like a short-term detox, it's far more important to think about the rhythms of our lives and those everyday things that we do. So unfortunately, doing something like a detox protocol and only drinking, you know, lemon water for a few days, it's not going to cancel out eating ultra-processed fast food for the rest of your days.
I mentioned this flippantly before, but Christina has asked a serious question. I'm cold. My husband is not. Will he live longer? I feel weak as I need more heaters on than most others. Can you please ask Dr. Kate about the virtues of staying colder?
Yeah, I'm not sure whether being a cold person or a warm person will make a longer term impact. I think we've all got our own comfort levels and our own levels of heat tolerance. So I don't know what the answer to that one is.
No. And perhaps it's not fully known. 23 minutes to midday. You say in this book, and this is important, that you came to understand that there is no conflict between the way we feel today and doing the best for our future. Can you flesh this out? What do you mean?
Yeah, and so this is a really important concept. And so often we talk about health in negative terms. We talk about eating well as denying ourselves, exercise as some kind of punishment for our bodies. But for me, it is so important that I feel really able to concentrate, that I'm energetic, that I'm engaged in life. And doing these things, so eating well is another really great example. There's evidence linking a diet that's got lots of vegetables, whole grains, healthy fats, with better mood. I've already spoken about the evidence with exercise, even things like including making sure that you stay socially connected. You know, we don't think about having a coffee with a friend as a part of our health regime, but it is. And these things are inherently rewarding in themselves as well. So it's really about reframing the way we think about health and about thinking about how these health behaviors actually can improve our well-being right now.
Yeah, and convincing ourselves deep down as opposed to realizing intellectually what's good for us. That's always the biggest challenge, isn't it?
That's right, yeah.
Have you struggled with that? Because you seem to be a very self-disciplined person, which is admirable, but presumably every human being has struggles along these lines.
Look, absolutely. And, you know, one thing I would say, I'm far from perfect, you know, in terms of I don't aspire to live a perfect life. I think perfect is sometimes the enemy of done. And what I would say is we're so often so harsh in the way we speak about ourselves. You know, I was speaking to someone recently and he was telling me he'd gone to the gym and then he was saying, but then I ate pizza and he was being really down on himself. And, you know, a way to reframe that is that he's done something great for himself by going to the gym. You know, we all enjoy some pizza with friends every now and then. And, you know, eating pizza for breakfast, lunch and dinner is not the best thing. But we should be focusing on the positives. We should be kind to ourselves, speaking to ourselves the way we'd speak to a friend. And I think that's actually a really important way to get more motivated.
Speaking of being kind, can you tell us what salutogenesis is?
Yeah, so this is a great concept that was developed by an Israeli sociologist. And so it really flips the way we think about health on its head. And so often we talk about health as almost a zero thing, that's the absence of disease by avoiding risk factors. But I think, but what about thinking about health as something positive? And so salutogenesis is the idea of including things that are good for us, including things that are important intrinsically in themselves, and creating health and well-being. So looking at why people remain healthy or why people recover from really difficult situations. And, you know, I think this is a really helpful framework to life, that rather that health is something to be valuable. And I prefer to think health much more, not in terms of just the absence of disease, because, you know, so many people do have chronic health conditions. I've got asthma myself, but doesn't mean I'm not healthy. And so thinking about health as something much more functional, something much more about that it helps us to engage better in life, helps us to enjoy life more, something valuable in its own right.
People are a big part of that equation, aren't they? Because you also talk about loneliness and by definition, the importance of friendship. People play a big part and that should be prioritised.
Absolutely. You know, humans are inherently social animals. And, you know, right now we've got supermarkets, but for most of our evolutionary history, we didn't. And so without other people, we literally couldn't survive. And so that feeling of isolation, that feeling of disconnect is a stress state. And when we get stressed, we have neurological and hormonal changes that can increase blood pressure, that can increase our risk of diabetes, and all of, and can be bad for brain health as well. And so it's so important to find fulfilling relationships. And one thing that's really interesting with loneliness is that it's subjective. And I regularly meet people who live with another person and they still feel lonely. But I also meet people who are quite solitary but very happy with their social connection. So it really is something that is subjective.
Yeah, and that's an important distinction. How much exercise keeps our brains and bodies healthy as we age? I notice you say 30 minutes a day. For some people that's daunting, for other people it's nothing. Of what quality?
So the current, I'm not sure what the New Zealand guidelines are, sorry, but the Australian ones are 150 minutes of moderate to high intensity exercise. So this would be getting enough exercise to be huffing and puffing a little. But what I'd say that most people don't do that's really critical for healthy aging is doing strength training. And there's a condition called sarcopenia, which is a loss of muscle strength and function that affects quite a lot of people in older age and can increase the risk of falls, and it's related to osteoporosis. So if you're looking at sort of the ideal, I mean, any exercise is better than nothing. So even going out walking is great. But if you're looking at really getting bang for your buck in terms of staying well into older age, combining some resistance training and also doing some balance training is really great way to optimize your chances of staying active for as long as possible.
You see, 150 minutes for some people does sound daunting. Isn't health science more and more agreeing that even short bursts of exercise can be really beneficial?
Look, short bursts of exercise, absolutely. When one thing is high intensity interval training, that's shown some positive impacts on some cellular age related changes. And so that's doing bursts, say, of 30 seconds to a minute of working it pretty much as hard as you can, then having 30 seconds to a minute of rest between. But what I would say is that for someone who's not already got a reasonable level of fitness, that's a really hard thing to do. And I do think that within a day, you know, even if it's just walking fast for 30 minutes, it's doable for most people. Just, you know, fitting in those 10 minutes, taking the stairs where you can, parking your car a bit further away. And if you make these positive changes, I think that a lot of people will notice that they feel better for it.
Julian wants to know, and he's not alone, about intermittent fasting and your opinions on that.
So the research on that is so interesting. And so fasting seems to kick ourselves into more of a repair mode, and thought that might be why it's really good for the aging process. What I would say is that in some large human studies, there hasn't been any benefit between intermittent fasting and caloric restriction. They seem to have pretty much the same effects. And so intermittent fasting really means not eating or eating very minimal kilojoules for a couple of days a week. And so it's not something that I do because I really like food, but I do generally not eat after dinner. So that's a slightly different thing, which is time restricted eating. And it's thought that giving your body a period of some hours, and it's not exactly clear how many hours you need to do this for to get benefit, but perhaps 10 or 12 hours a day might have some similar benefits with that.
Yeah. Okay. So for example, you eat between midday and 8 o'clock at night and fast. That's a common one, isn't it? Or else you...
Yeah.
There's the 5-2 days per week too, but it's not actually that complicated to do.
No, but the one thing I would say, my other sort of criticism with the intermittent fasting is it's so important with nutrition that we don't just focus on what we take out, we focus on what we put in. And I'd say if someone's doing intermittent fasting, but again, otherwise eating burgers and chips, then probably not doing themselves any favours and probably not really countering it.
Bernadette's story in your book, Anxiety and Depression Can Mimic Dementia. What did you prescribe for Bernadette?
Yeah, so this is one of these things that we see commonly when I get patients who are referred because of memory issues. It's quite tricky sometimes working out what's anxiety and depression and what's true dementia, because people with anxiety and depression, they just thinking can be slowed, memory is not working as well. And so when I see someone who's got those sorts of things, you know, depression is a really complex condition. It has biological underpinnings, but it's also often affected by what's going on with our social circumstances, not unsurprisingly. And so when I see someone in general who's got those sorts of issues, I find out what's going on in their lives. I find out, we talk about particular stresses. We talk about stress management, if that's appropriate. I prescribe antidepressants when they're indicated, and also look at trying to get people doing a bit more exercise because that's also good for anxiety and depression.
Do you encounter rebellion in your household? Do the children ever long for a Big Mac? Does your husband smuggle in Mars bars?
So look, you know, we do have our Friday night treats where we get our burgers and chips or fish and chips. We don't live, you know, an ascetic lifestyle. The kids, kids are kids. They will be fussy at certain times. And I just generally just try and do my best to get them eating their vegetables and setting them up for good habits through their lifetime.
Congratulations on your book, Kate. There's a lot in it. And I hope we've covered a certain amount that's useful to our listeners. Staying Alive, Dr. Kate Gregorovich has been with us. And thank you very much for your company.
Thank you for a great conversation.